Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. This is Ken McCusick. We're back for part two of the countdown of the top cornerbacks in the 2024 draft. I am absolutely privileged to have Coach Derek here of All 22 Films to talk about it with me. Coach, how you doing?
Good, man. I feel the same way. Likewise, you know, whenever you or anyone asks me to come on, it's always fun, but you're a monster. Like, people, nobody ever asks someone to come on and says, hey, man, can you do 2 hours? You know, I get people that are like, hey, can you come on my show for about 15 minutes, or, you know, radio show? Like, hey, can you do 10 or 12 minutes? Like, two hours is a different thing. And it speaks to the level of detail and the seriousness which with you approach it, and the people listening, you know, who appreciate that. They want that level of detail, that level of attempt, at least, to study the game. So, you know, it's fun for me.
We need to pay homage to the fans of both of our channels for a moment here and just say how great they are. I mean, I appreciate you guys to no end, to the fact that you memorize things that I say and use them against me at a future time. There's some of that. But I really appreciate all of the very diligent review, all the kind comments are very much appreciated. We've often said if you go out and do a 5-star review of the show in 50 words, bring new people to it. I want more people to bring their fathers into the podcast. You know, I'm that age. I could be a lot of people's father at age 60. and believe me, I still don't download a podcast regularly. I'll go online. I'll watch a YouTube video. I'll watch a ton of those. I'll listen to my own podcast to make sure that the production values are okay, which has not always been the case in the past, but I'll listen to that and make sure things are right. But I don't tend to download a bunch of podcasts on my phone. And, you know, one of the things I want people to do, and this would be appropriate for your channel too, is tell your dad about Coach Derek's channel. Get him to watch it once, and he can watch it directly from his computer. He can watch it if he's got a smart TV on YouTube. He can watch it on his phone. You can watch it a lot of different places, and you know all those, but he doesn't. And your dad, I'm sure, has a different set of experiences with Ravens history that I would love to tap into, particularly, you know, talking about, you know, players from the Ravens past. And you know, I'm trying to get people encouraged into bringing not just the younger generation, but the older generation into an interest in analytics, an interest in understanding football in kind of a different way maybe than they grew up with.
Yeah, it's pretty cool, first of all. Second of all, like my dad is a Colts fan.
Yep. There you go.
I mean, he's a Ravens fan too, don't get me wrong, but he's a Colts fan. And he's one of those guys you can remember. I'm sure they're the same way. You remember, you know, Colts players that were overrated, underrated, or didn't work out or got injured. So yeah, that's pretty cool, man. I, as far as like my channel goes, like I've just been blown away, like I said in the first episode, of the support and the people who have said kind things. And there's times where I read a comment and I kind of have to like put my phone down and walk away. You know, my wife is like, you know, did you ever think that people would actually want to hear you talk about football? No. You know, because my way as a coach of talking about football was generally pretty abrasive or too direct. And so in this manner, this is something I get to be a little bit more balanced with, you know, hopefully more myself with, whereas I felt like coaching, there was always that time factor. You only have 42 minutes for this defensive practice, or 12 minutes for this drill, or 90 seconds left in this drill period. And we got to get this point across. Otherwise we can't stop that particular play. So there was always that time constraint that brought out an aspect of my personality that never shows up in my videos, thankfully, you know. So
that works for us, is that I mean, not only do you not have to get mad, if that's what you're referring to, and it, you know, bringing out the worst, like a bad craps roll in Las Vegas, but we also don't have any time limits, so don't feel the need to feel pressure on that stuff.
Yeah, everything from a coaching standpoint was always, you know, constrained and a certain amount of time to get to. And kids, people don't understand that sometimes. It's like, hey, even in the NFL, there's some time constraints. You know, it's not the same. You don't get 42 minutes or 47 minutes, you know, for your practice in every drill period. Hell, your movement between drills had to be scripted, for me at least. You know, hey, guys, we have 45 seconds to get to the next drill and get set up. And those things at the NFL level are a little bit different, but there's still constraints. And you see that sometimes, I think, on the defensive side of the ball. But anyway, I know you're ready to go with your, what are we on, six or seven?
Number seven pick. My number seven corner, we'll jump right in, is Kyrie Jackson of Oregon. Probably a third round value to the Ravens. He could well be gone before that. Again, you know, my philosophy is talk about the round where he has value to the Ravens, not the round that you necessarily think you have to draft him to make sure you get him, because that's being a need guy. But 6'4", 194, almost 33-inch arms. So in terms of size, he's the biggest guy by a mile in this draft. 4'5", 40, which is good. Good and great jumps. Here's the big thing. He'll be 25 in August, and he's only got 25 career games played between Alabama and Oregon. So,
and JUCO. Yeah,
the JUCO, he had additional games played, but in terms of FBS football, he's only got 25 games played. Great 2023 metrics with 5.3 yards per target, a 41.6 opposition passer rating. To put that in context, 39.6 is every passing complete. So you have to load in some interceptions there to have a chance to get an opposition passer rating that low. Had a great 2023 season, obviously, as a 24-year-old, great press size length, and played about as much of it as anyone in 2023 at Oregon. I think, you know, if I had to pick something that I didn't like about him, watching what I did in 23, and I'm really interested to hear what you say, because I know you like this guy. He's a guy who is more marionetteable at the top of the stem. So when he's in off coverage, he's immediately putting himself outside his comfort zone, because that wide receiver, if he's a good leverage reader, he's dead. If he's a good wiggle thrower or even a sudden athlete, he gives a corner like Kyrie Jackson trouble. And part of that is just size and change of direction ability. But the other part of it is that he often will make a misguess and a false read off a first move. So it's kind of a deadly habit to have, but he's so otherwise physically gifted. I think that he's a guy who could certainly be coached up at the NFL level. Great prospect for the Ravens to consider. He's a one contract player, so you gotta go in with that understanding. The absolute highest I'll draft a one contract player is round three. So if somebody else likes him and drafts him in round two, okay, he's their problem, or their game potentially. But you know, he'll be almost 30 years old when he's looking for his second contract, and you know, there aren't a lot of the frictions, a lot of the value you get from a second contract by having an early extension. For example, you're buying men into more of a decline phase with that player that I think is not as good. So anyway, that's my brief look at Kyrie.
No, first of all, totally in line with how I view Kyrie Jackson. Kudos to you, because you had the guts to put him in your top 10. I did not. I do really like him. I think that talent-wise, he belongs there. He's so smooth. There's times where I think he I thought he looked bored, to be honest with you, last year, in almost – I don't want to say inviting throws. I don't mean that at all, because at the college level, especially that level, a coach is going to pick up on that. Kyrie, you're not doing what you're supposed to do. This is BS, because you're trying to bait this throw, and that's not what we're coaching you to do. I'm not saying he did that. I'm saying that there's times where it looked to me like he could run a little faster than he did, and then when the ball's in the air, he recovers. I think he's got tremendous talent. Somewhere in the last 2 years, there was a quote. Someone shared it on Twitter a couple of times recently, when he was at Alabama. This is during a time when Brian Branch, Terrion Arnold, Kool-Aid McKinstry were all in that room. Someone said that he was the most talented DB in that room. Of course, he ends up leaving. Now, whether that was true or not, someone said that, who was affiliated with Alabama's program. If you know anybody who's affiliated with Alabama's program, I've known two. And they're amazing football coaches. They're people that they're in the room, and you're you're blown away by their knowledge and their ability to convey what's going on. So Kyrie Jackson, I think, absolutely third round value. I agree. Totally in line with, but you, and I may have even wrote this. I'm doing a video on Maryland DC players because he's from Wise High School in PG County, which is a amazing high school program, football program. They're one of the bigger, for years, they were one of the bigger public schools in the state. I'm not sure where they are now, but I even put, like, you don't want to, there's no need to reach and take him at 62 because there's going to be another good corner available at 93 or 113 or wherever the Ravens end up. So as from a Ravens perspective, getting Kyrie Jackson, I don't think he fits with where we're going to pick him because I think he's gone by 93. But I know there's a lot of other people who do not agree with us, Ken. They don't think that he will be gone in that range. I certainly do, but getting back to that point from last segment, there's only so many players who can be taken up to 92. There's exactly 92 of them. So Kyrie Jackson, you know, may actually be there at 93. That will be an interesting choice. If we, let's do it this way, Ken, you're the show host, but I ask you a question. If we haven't taken a corner, if we've addressed O-line and wide receiver sufficiently at 30 in the first round and the second round, would you take him at 93?
I'd be fine with him at 93. Yeah.
100% agreed here. So, same here. I actually like all three of the Maryland corners. And when I say Maryland corners, I mean guys who played high school in Maryland football. Kalen Carson, Kyrie Jackson, and Cam Hart. I like all three of them. Jackson's the most talented of the group with the size.
All right. Incredible potential. So you did not have him on your list. So who's your number six guy then?
Max Melton.
Okay.
Only had three games of him. Well, excuse me. Only had three games of him, but two of them was against Ohio State. And I thought he matched up well in those scenarios. I didn't think that he was targeted much in two of the other games that when I say watched, I had two other games that I just kind of like let play on the screen. And everybody has the same supplier for College All 22 film. So there's a little yellow arrow that points to the guy. So I know I just got to look up every 30 seconds, catch him, you know, watch the 6, 8, 10 seconds. And then I don't have to watch the end zone angle because it's a corner. So what difference does it make? I can do whatever else I'm doing on my second screen. When I saw him against Michigan, they did target him. Michigan beat him on a back shoulder twice. One time was completed for a touchdown. One time it was not. He looks very scheme versatile to me. First of all, second of all, the Rutgers defense, of course, they did lose to Michigan. They did lose to Ohio State. I thought they were competitive in both of those games for about a quarter and a half or 2 to 2.5 quarters. And their defense, everybody got to the football. Everybody played at the proper angles. Max Melton reminds me of Brandon Stevens because he's so athletic. And I don't remember Brandon Stevens back then. I certainly don't. But he looks like a guy who's more ready to play a wide variety of coverages than I imagine Brandon Stevens was 3, 4, 5 years ago. And that could be, you know, that might not be an accurate statement, but that's how highly I think of him. He reminds me of Brandon Stevens. And last thing on him, I think he did have a 9.2 RAS score, like top 5, 6 in the corner group, 4.39, 40, I think. I really like him.
Bench 40.5 vert. And 11.4 broads. He's the outstanding athletic profile.
Yeah, really, really impressive, I think, specimen for a corner that is probably there at 62. You know, in that range, let's put it that way.
Okay. I think he probably would be available at 62. I had some problems with him. It's not that I didn't love the guy, but I had to drop him out of my top 10. So we've got a little bit less overlap on the list maybe. But he's about I don't want to page up, but I forget if he's at 12 or he's at 14 for me. I'll take a look in just a minute. Love the athletic profile. Love the fact that he doesn't turn 22 until tax day this year. So he's a very young player. His 2023 metrics were very good. Not quite at the top of the class, but 5.7 yards per target and a 65.7 opposition passer rating. That's just fine. He did a little bit of traveling, but he made a primary change from left corner to right corner at midseason this year. So he was
correct.
Yeah. And that yeah. He didn't have a favorite shoulder to me that was showing up. And so that's something we talk about this. You can maybe explain it further from a coaching perspective. But some cornerbacks, they just like to play over one shoulder. They're better at tracking the football over one shoulder than over the other. Maybe describe it how you would as a coach.
I mean, yeah, certainly. All positions, you know, some people are right and left defensively. Some people are TJ Watt. He's a left outside linebacker, you know, lefty end in a versus 11 personnel. Some people switch strong and weak. It's personal philosophy. Some people switch strong and weak only in certain situations. Most people are field and boundary at a certain point. From a DB perspective, there's absolutely Marcus Peters. You know, and then there's guys, Marlon Humphrey, that can do either one, and then they can slide inside and play slot corner also, yeah. In the same, you know, the same body is able to do that, which is kind of, you know, unbelievable. I didn't describe it that way from Melton, but I do remember that there was a film from 2022 where he played on the left, and then this year there was one from the left and one from the right. So I didn't connect that together. I was a really big fan of how he tackled until I saw one real bad missed tackle, you know? So then I was like, okay, you know, I got a small sample size of three games, but two outstanding games. I don't even remember who they were that I just let flow through. It's fun to watch this much film, but I'll be honest with you. It's this year was a lot more fun to me because I said, all right, I'm just going to focus on corners to the exclusion of other positions. I didn't watch a single offensive line snap at all in a detailed manner. I mean, Jordan Morgan, Graham Barton, the guys the Ravens might draft, I did check them out. But dudes who I know they're not going to draft, I wasn't going to sit and watch that film.
I can understand that. I got a little more to say about Melton here. He did have a big problem with missed tackles in his career in general. He's over 16%, 26.7% this last year. That's a real problem. He only had 10 stops the whole year, but he had 12 missed tackles. So that's not a good percentage there, not a good ratio. He also had five penalties. Now, a lot of the guys at this level are so physically gifted that they don't have problems with grabbiness. And in fact, a lot of the guys we're talking about tonight, because it's the top 10, really have very few penalties in aggregate between them. But Melton was one of the guys who picked up a few penalties.
That doesn't surprise me. Yeah, it doesn't surprise me at all.
Bit of a project, coaching project, but then again, you got a 22-year-old and you got a chance to really have him go for it. And he's not a 22-year-old like JAD who has no experience at the college level. He's got that. It's just he's got to get on the field and I think get more coaching, more live fire. Not be hurt maybe during camp would be a big freaking deal for a player like him to get acclimated to a new system.
Is Rutgers still – this will be the second iteration of Shiano, right?
I don't know.
I think Shiano's back, and I may be mispronouncing his name. All I know is whoever's running Rutgers defense knows what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And in the games where I saw them, I was impressed, particularly against Michigan. They stood up to Michigan's physicality, and he was one of the guys. He reminds me of him and Kalen Carson, I would say, are similar in the fact that they're nasty corners to deal with. I'm a big fan of Max Melton, obviously, just like, you know, you put Kyrie Jackson in your top 10. I put Melton in mine, really based off of the Ohio State game. But then when I watched the Michigan game, you know, Michigan did go at him. J.J. McCarthy made two amazing throws to his side. One of them complete for a touchdown. One of them ended up being incomplete.
OK, so Melton, I do have at number 12 on my list just to confirm. And the comment I have about value and round, and this is more about economics than anything, because I like Haddon better than him. I'd take him first if I had the choice. But if the Ravens decided they wanted Melton at number 93, I'd just be OK with it. I wouldn't be excited about it. If they got him at 113, I'd be excited about the value.
Yeah, most of these guys that are, you know, beyond the first four or five that are, you know, not in our range at all. Right. I would be happy with if we got after we've addressed offensive line, you know, wide receiver. At this point, after signing Kyle Van Noy, we don't have to address outside linebacker. I don't think it's a particularly, I really don't like enjoy saying this. I don't think it's a particularly impressive outside linebacker defensive end group in this draft. And I think DaCosta even said that the other day. Even some of the top of the line guys at that position, to me, don't look like guys who come in and start at all over the players that we currently have. So from that standpoint, once we've addressed receiver and outside linebacker, really any of the players we've, you know, talked about tonight so far, I'd be happy if we get at 93. Because I'm confident the rest of the roster, you know, what we have, if we're healthy.
Well, we obviously don't know that, but we can't ponder or plan for the imponderables anyway, other than to get more depth, and a corner is one of those positions mm-hmm. you're doing. Move on to number six, who I think we might already talked about.
Yep, Melton.
I'm sorry. So my number six guy is TJ Tampa. So we already talked about him. So we're up to number five. I'm guessing Kool-Aid. The same five guys that you have not mentioned.
Kool-Aid McKinstry. Okay. Not great athletic testing. So he reminds me of Branch from the standpoint of how intelligent he seems to be. Anyone who's played in that system and been able to produce. I know there's some questions about discipline, attitude, perhaps, I guess, is what some people have mentioned. Anyone who's played in that system and been as prepared as he looks pre-snap and been able to position players, I think has got to have a high level of intelligence, got to be trusted by the coaches because he's doing those things. And then, I mean, I don't think he's a guy who just can't play man. I disagree with that summary judgment of McKinstry. He can't play man. In the match system that Alabama plays, you have to be able to play man on demand mod. And so based upon the route, you have to be able to match the coverage. If he can do that, he can play man. Now, what a lot of people refer to when they say he can't play man is they refer to press man. Well, press man is different now in 2024 than it was 10 years, 15 years ago anyway. A lot of us have a conception of what press man is on the line of scrimmage, get my hands on immediately. Some of the releases that receivers do, we're not able to get our hands on them. And we're dissuaded by the NFL rules from doing some of those things that corners used to do anyway. It's not a big deal to me when a guy like McKinstry is supposedly not a great man defender because he plays in a match quarter system and plays it extremely well. I don't think he's interested in tackling at all at times. So I don't know what the tackle percent is, but I know there's a high percentage of plays where he's not really interested or not doing a good job of getting off blocks. His RAS score was high enough for me to say that, you know, I think he's going to come in and play from day one for somebody. Does he come in and start over Stevens and Marlon Humphrey if they're both healthy? That's difficult for me to say. I don't know that he'll be there, you know, for us, to be real.
At 30, now you're talking about.
Yeah. So I really like him. I like him a lot more than other people do. I don't have the fears about him playing man. Certainly not long term. What I mean is, you know, year two, year three, I think you're going to see some improvement in him. But anyway, do you have him at five also?
I have him at four. So, and I like him. I think he's a guy you get in either the first or second round. He's one of the guys who's on the table at the intersection of Need and Value Street. I think it's likely somebody else of real value drops to 30 that the Ravens maybe can't pass up on. But he's one of the guys who, you know, maybe deserves to be drafted 23rd, and you could see him drafted at 30 or 20.
100%. Absolutely. There's going to be players pushed down the draft. Yep.
So anyways, his metrics were very good this last year, 5.3 yards per target in particular, 73.1 opposition passer rating. I agree with you about the comments out of Alabama. Even to play in that system as a true freshman and play 3 years, that tells you everything you need to know after Alabama has basically been holding very talented corners off the field for three seasons before they get on.
Kyrie Jackson. Yeah. You know, Kyrie. So, yeah, absolutely.
J.A.D. I mean, you know, it was another guy. And you know, we laugh at that because he hasn't been that good with the Ravens, but still had to really wait his turn, and it really stunted his growth in a lot of ways. But McKinstry didn't have to go through that. Let's see what I else had to say about that. Also, yeah, I did like, you know, it's one thing to say he can't play man. I'll say it the other way, is that I think he's a very good cover three cornerback, and he baits the quarterback in certain ways that I really like. Is that some of that Marcus Peters marionette the quarterback in a certain way to get him to do what you want him to. It had led to a lot of ball production in his first 2 years, less in his third season, probably because they're very wary of him at this point. His targets were the lowest in all of college football this last year, one every 11.7 snaps. So right there, that tells you all you need to know about them, you know, staying away from him. It's a difficult choice probably at the end of the that round for the Ravens, and I hope it's a very difficult choice if Kool-Aid's on the table, because I hope it also means, you know, that it's a left tackle is on the table at the same time, whether that's Sua Mataia, who I really like, or even one of the other ones that's more projected to left tackle. But the real guys who are projected there probably will all be gone, will be left with a project left tackle pick at that point. And I think that as much as people love the cornerback position, you got a lot more of a chance to get a corner in round 2, 3, or 4 that you like and can play that position and will be only a tick below your top, your a 30 pick. You know, not a 4 pick, but a 30 pick.
100%.
Yeah. That you, at left tackle, you got like no chance to get that guy in round 4 or 5.
100%. Yep. It's got to be compared to, you know, our needs and then also the depth of the positional group in the draft and where we project certain guys, you know, all those simulations. Now, hey, but like you said, like you mentioned, a guy like Kyle Hamilton falls to us. You know, Kyle Hamilton would never fall to 30, but he fell to us, you know, that year. And they, I think it was three of the simulations out of like 2,000 had him being available for the Ravens.
Something with a random element to it, obviously.
Something that was, hey, this is not what we expected at all. You know, so if that happens and there's someone there that the Ravens can't pass up, I hope they take them. And I think they got to have those contingency plans in. Oh, there's someone here at 30 such that we can't take a tackle. We've got to figure out a way to move, you know, whether that's 52, 40. I keep thinking Saints at 45, not to, get off track here. I keep thinking Saints at 45. They got no fourth and no third and no fourth, you know, this year at all. And so that's the team I keep thinking that we try to move up to,
move and from 62 to 45 to pick up a corner.
Absolutely. Yep. And get them if they're satisfied with what they get at 14 and don't feel like they. Yeah, that's the team I keep thinking to myself is I don't some of the other trade projections I don't think are realistic, like Washington. I mean, why would Washington trade out of 36 and 40? You know, what's the difference between 36 and 40 and 30? So, yeah, but in any case, man. Yeah, exactly. I think McKinstry, if he falls to 30, that means we're in a good place because that means a whole heck of a lot of receivers and quarterbacks and unfortunately tackles have been taken at that point to push him down, you know, down the board. He's a really good player. I think he's scheme diverse. Super prepared for the level of preparation there is in the NFL. Like, I mean, him and Terrion Arnold, who did they throw at? What's Terrion Arnold's targets per game? You know?
Yeah, we'll get to that in a minute here, but it's definitely a team that didn't need to travel. They didn't need mm-hmm. to, they didn't need to send their best corner all over the field chasing a good receiver. Yep. So I guess we're to my number 5 guy, right? Mm-hmm. This is one of the really interesting guys in the draft. And I mentioned Kadar Holman in the opening discussion of what the Ravens' current situation is. But Quinyon Mitchell is my number 5 guy. And he has a lot in common with him. Went to Toledo. Both of them are Toledo products. You mentioned you have a lot of fans who like Lions football. I think Quinyon is from Detroit, if I recall correctly. So he's a guy the Lions fans probably would just love to get. Played great at Toledo. His metrics are absolutely fantastic. His measurables are fantastic and extremely similar metrics. And if you have RAS score from back then, maybe it'd be interesting to like look at these. But the 40 time, 4:33 for Quinyon Mitchell and 4:39 for Holman. They're both, you know, 6'0", 195 guys, 31-inch arms approximately for both of them. So very, very similar. Quinyon had a 38-inch vert. He'll be 23 in July, so it makes him a little older than some of the quarterbacks, but not corners, but not as old as all of them. So in terms of the testing measurables, he's good. In terms of the on-field production metrics, he's excellent, 4.7 yards per target and a 51.1 opposition passer rating being the big two stick-out numbers. They threw at him a lot at Toledo, and one of the reasons is he plays off coverage, and he often tries to bait the quarterback to throw the ball in front of him. He's constantly playing that game with the quarterback directly. And he could do it with the quarterbacks at that level because they just are not as sophisticated as NFL quarterbacks or even, you know, the Power 5 quarterbacks in the MAC. And you know, he was very effective at doing that. So he had 37 passes defensed the last two seasons with 6 interceptions. And he had a lot of targets. He was 40th percentile, roughly 105th best in terms of fewest targets. We just talked about the guy who was number 1 in McKinstry. Well, he was number 105, one every 6.6 snaps pure off-ball reader, really doesn't get up into press coverage, even though he's a guy who has all the size necessary to do it at 6'0", 195 and you know, decent reach. I think the context is where you really need to look at this guy and say, does this make sense? He's a little older than most of the guys in the MAC, and he's a whole hell of a lot better than most of the guys in the MAC. And then again, the MAC isn't, you know, North Dakota State. So we had prospects come out of that. We have to look at them completely differently. But it's an interesting thing. And EDC had a comment at Liar's Luncheon about considering the context. He has not had very many non-Power 5 picks.
Right.
Surprising to me that because of the small school reputation he had in terms of his scouting.
Yeah, Toledo, to be honest with you, they, first of all, extremely high-level football program. Different. Mm-hmm. There's just a different – I can speak on this from two levels. I know two people who've been recruited by those schools and had the opportunity to be informed, let me put it that way, by a person close to me about one of the tours, and he was blown away. He said it blew away two Power 5 teams that he went to in terms of – not the presentation, not the offer, but what was being done in the building. So that was point number one. But point number two, I thought super athletic, Mitchell. If they're playing a lot of off coverage, which I have three games of him, I believe. Yeah, three games. If they're playing a lot of off coverage, my guess is you're probably talking about a lot of quarter split field stuff. And then you're seeing him break on balls because he's identifying routes. But that's just a guess. I don't remember those plays off the top of my head. I did think he was a little stiff. Super athletic and a straight. I have written down extremely good straight line speed. And I thought his hips were a little stiff for a guy who's rated as high as he is. Does it mean I think he can't play? No. I think he's an exceptional talent. Is it possible that someone drafts him in the first 10, 12 picks and he turns into an elite shutdown corner in a year or two? Sure, it's absolutely possible. But I was less than impressed with his agility, even though his RAS score is off the charts. I think
where did you have him?
9.79. Oh, I have met three. Yeah. I've met three, but I just was not as – I didn't think he was as fluid as like a Nate Wiggins. I didn't think he was able to move at any angle. We call them breaks, 90, you know, 45 break, 90 break, 180, 3, whatever. I didn't think he was as fluid with his breaks as those other guys were. But he could
explain
be playing.
Explain to folks what you mean by those breaks. Obviously, those are angles. Angles to what?
Where you're facing.
Okay, so
wherever you're facing right now, imagine, you know, that's forward. So a 0 degree break straight downhill right now, a 45 to your right, you know, off your right shoulder, 45 to your left, 90, an out route, 90. Mm-hmm. Teaching the breaks, we would talk about routes. So the DB coach would teach breaks, and then he would talk about what route is that. And so the kid was expected, we're talking, you know, 12, 13, 14 year old kids. The kid was expected to understand what route am I breaking on a 90 degree break? It's an out route. What route am I breaking on a 135 on a 180. And then a baseball turn is taught off. It's a progression. So you're talking about turning in a certain direction at a certain angle because of the route that's being run. I thought Quinyon Mitchell looked less fluid than the other high-level guys. Again, we're talking about top of the food chain corners in the NFL draft. So for me, compared to those guys, he looked less fluid on those breaks. Does it mean I think he can't play? No, I think he can. I think he gets drafted in the first, you know, 16, 18, 20 picks, contingent upon how many quarterbacks and tackles are taken as well. He's one of those guys that I had at three, but I wanted to put at five or six.
Okay. In terms of economics, I mean, he probably deserves to be at three. I actually moved him from four to five after watching a cut-up that was very well narrated. And one of the things he noticed about Quinyon Mitchell that he didn't like was he was opening his hips with the receiver still 5 yards off him. And it was a specific case of, he opened his hips to the outside. That's very dangerous, obviously, because there's a lot of feel to the inside.
It's a man term.
Yeah. So if you go to the outside, you better be right, is what I'll tell you in terms of opening and putting your hips too early. And he wasn't on this particular case. And then he still had some makeup speed to get back in the play. But of course, it's the Mac, the quarterback, the wide receiver. Right. We're not on the same page necessarily that they would be at the NFL level. The ball came in with a fair amount of air underneath it instead of on a line. And he's able to make a play on the football at the end, or actually make a play on the guy's hands. That's a really good cutup, by the way. I thought that it did a very good job of explaining this concept about cornerbacks opening their hips too early.
It's a valid point to mention the MAC conference, which has it's a really good level of football. It does, mm-hmm. But compared to Alabama, Georgia, Tennessee last year had the year before, Hendon Hooker, Jalen Hyatt. Every year there's high-level receivers that you have to face. Those guys are just not in the MAC. They're just not. Every now and then you'll get a really good one who's probably a third or fourth round pick. But the SEC has six or eight first, second, third round receivers. Maybe not six or eight every year, but at least three or four. I have some concerns about Mitchell's ability to fluidly break on things, but other people don't share that concern. So maybe I'm a little off base there. Nonetheless, I still had him at three.
Okay, very good. I do want to make this point, and I hate to tick us off track here, but the NIL and the transfer portal and what that's done for college football. Obviously, it's changed the whole notion of things. Even people getting drafted later ages because they're staying around for NIL money because they go to the transfer portal. They want the exposure at a big school. But it also turns conferences like the MAC a lot of times into feeder leagues for the Power Five.
100%.
Their best players end up going for NIL money in what would be their best season. So you definitely don't get the top level. It's like having a brain drain if you're New Zealand or if you're Pakistan or something. Your top brains want to go somewhere else to live.
Shocking, man. People can look online and see the numbers themselves. I will not tell you who, but I know two people what they've been offered, given, signed for. On a yearly basis, and they're 18-year-old kids. It's more than most people's salaries. So, completely unproven at that level. So, pretty interesting to me that's where the game is. Multiple games, basketball, football, whatever. And I think it also provides opportunity for some of these other smaller schools to retain talent, to sign talent. If they have incredible financial backing, which would be something somewhat random, a billionaire benefactor who happened to go to their school. So in the case of Quinyon Mitchell, is it possible that down the road he would have been are the future Quinyon Mitchells going to end up at Alabama or Georgia when they're a junior if they didn't commit there as a freshman or a sophomore? Yeah, it's definitely – it's definitely more likely. And we see that already.
All right, well, let's move on here. I think we haven't gotten to your number four guy because you had Quinyon at number three and I had Kool-Aid at number four. But who is your four?
Cooper DeJean. Okay. I'm way more impressed with Cooper DeJean than some of the draft profiles I read. I don't think he's a safety. Could he play safety? Absolutely. Absolutely he could. Injuries, I think he got hurt in mid-late November or something like that. Super athletic guy. I don't remember his RAS score. I don't know if you have that or not. I refer to that because it just does a nice job of comparing them. For me, when I see the guys that are – it's like his RAS is the 39th all-time RAS scores for his position. I'm like, okay, that's something to consider versus the guy who's 250th or 300th or something, which is still pretty high level. I really liked Cooper DeJean film. I didn't like, however, when quarterbacks broke the pocket, there was two situations, one against Ohio State. The other one may have been Michigan. I could be wrong, where someone was able to get open. He kind of lost track of them. It wasn't that he was physically beat at all. It was the conflict he was put in by the quarterback scrambling out to the edge and trying to determine, okay, do I go get the quarterback or do I cover this guy here? Both of the, those, it was two situations that seem anomalous, but for the games that I studied, which was four of them, Michigan, Ohio State, Penn State, Rutgers, was the film that I had of him. 23? One of those, I think, was a 22 game. I don't have it marked here, so I don't want to misspeak and say yes. I could be wrong. I think he's a hell of a football player. I don't think he's there for the Ravens at 30, to be honest with you. But again, that, I guess that depends on the tackles and quarterbacks that get drafted prior to that. I don't know what your concerns are, but I didn't have many, to be honest with you. I loved the punt return fourth quarter that would have won the game. I think I called back for a penalty. I thought that was an amazing moment. Even on the possession before that, he had a stop on that possession, I think a tackle. So I think he's a great football player.
He does some amazingly brainy things on the field, in addition to being a great athlete. And you covered that, I think, with the RAS score. His 2023 metrics in terms of his production were outstanding at 4.2 yards per target. It's just ridiculously good. And a 37.8 opposition passer rating. That's better in terms of passer rating than every pass incomplete. So it just gives you an idea of the spot he's in. He was every bit as good with better ball production in 2022, when he had 5.9 yards per target, a little worse, but with five interceptions and a 49.7 opposition passer rating. So he's been a shutdown guy by any measure the last few years. Probably what I liked about DeJean the most was his leverage reads at the top of the stem and the safety's understanding of route combinations. Now, this is something I often say about dimebacks who move up. Our longtime safeties, obviously, and then move up to play dime at the NFL level. And they don't even have to be, guys who can even handle the safety position on the back end, even on a split field basis, all that well. But they understand the route concepts. They understand what they're looking for. And what it gives them is, even when they're playing up front, they know what's going on behind them and beside them to a much greater degree.
And absolutely.
So, yeah, really saw that out of Gene in terms of this year and his – what is a great pass off guy in terms of stuff. His interception versus Rutgers is such a play. It was one of the greatest plays I saw by any player at any position in 23. It's just ridiculously good. Go watch it. The play it should remind you of. There's one particular play. I almost don't want to spoil it for you, but I will, from Ravens history that it will remind you of. And that's Ed Reed's interception against the Dolphins in the 2008 wildcard game. He basically came off his own man, rolls on back to help on someone else, catches a ball completely over his, coming directly over his head. Hardest ball to catch. Hardest ball to catch by far. Doesn't have either shoulder to look over. He has to track the ball directly over his head. Makes the catch, turns around, runs it back for a touchdown. Almost exactly the same track that Ed Reed ran on, by the way. Start the left side, go to the right side, pick up blocks, and go the distance. It will shock you, is similarity to that Reed interception and touchdown if you watch it. But that was spectacular. Just one of the great plays of this year that I saw. The other game I watched in great detail was the 2022 cutoff versus Ohio State. And that's why I asked you about this, because we may have been looking at the same game.
That must have been it. Yeah.
Because he got beat on a very long play in that game. It wasn't a particularly great game for him. And that's the game I want to watch, because I want to watch an average game or a bad game, but I don't want to watch a great game, because then all I'm going to do is confirm all the nice things that people are saying about the guy.
CJ Stroud. You had C.J. Stroud and Marvin Harrison Jr., and I mean, you had all those guys. So absolutely, yeah, it was definitely 2022. I don't have it marked, but, sorry.
He actually got beat on the play by Julian Fleming, who was number four for Ohio State. It was a big pass, 79-yard pass, deep cross, which puts him in the worst possible position because he's up against a slightly bigger receiver. DeJean's 6'1", but Fleming is 6'1".
This is the place where Black is the main character, where we dive into something new like the latest season of Vim, The Scare, and the award-winning American Fiction. Or add to the experience by buying or renting the biopic of a legend, Bob Marley, One Love. And add on channels like Paramount Plus and Stars to bask in nostalgia with Beverly Hills Cop and BMF. Explore Prime Video's culture-rated collection and enjoy old-school greats and new-school hits. Restrictions apply. See Amazon.com/AmazonPrime for details.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Too, and you know, a little bit heavier guy, and you know, it puts all of his long speed in question. Versus a player there, and he did a great job of not only catching the ball, Fleming did, but getting away from DeJean in this case and scoring is isolated on a very difficult route. My problem with DeJean is they don't gain as much from his versatility if the Ravens were to get him. So I love him at outside cornerback. I think he'll be just fine. And I think he's probably worth the 30th pick at outside corner. I think somebody else is going to value him more because they say this guy can do for us what Kyle Hamilton has done for the Ravens.
Yep.
In fact, you know, we can move him all over. We can maybe a more apt description might be a player like the Honey Badger or somebody like that. Somebody who really can play corner if you need him to. Hamilton's not an outside corner, but he's a great football player. If he is there at 30, the Ravens have to consider him. And I think they have to consider how they would use him as well, which I think has to be as a pure outside corner.
No, totally agree. By the way, Fleming is a high level recruit from Pennsylvania that Pennsylvania football fans were pissed off, went to Ohio State, obviously. But I mean, you know, what do you do when Ohio State recruits you to play receiver with the receivers coach they've had? But he's gone in the portal, Fleming, and gone back to Penn State now to finish out his career. But in any case, he's a good player. But my wife's from Pennsylvania, so the Penn State people are all over our gatherings and everything. They're nuts. But look, I agree with you, totally in line with what I would say about him. He's not going to be there at 30. If he is, then it's serious consideration to take him and then look to hopefully trade back in to gather an offensive lineman that will help immediately or soon. Additional to that, a guy like DeJean, maybe I'm saying his name wrong, you know, forgive me for that. If he's there at 30, we're going to get some calls. We're going to get some calls to trade back if he is there. So yeah, the talent
point, great point there, by the way, that, you know, it gives you options. If DeJean is on the board at 30, it gives you options because you can pick him if you think you can use him. You can trade back or you can decide I have needs that go above this. I can otherwise do it. But there's going to be guys who want DeJean. I also say if there's one quarterback left at that point, that might also be another really good spot because there will be a team that wants to get that fifth-year option on a quarterback also. And that could be if we're down in Knicks and Penix and one of them is taken in the late 20s, and you know it's one is left, and the Ravens hold pick 30. That's a place of you know that pick all of a
sudden. Absolutely, absolutely. Correct me if I'm wrong. The teams in front of us there are the Lions, the Bills, and the Cardinals at 29, 28, 27. Prior to us, three teams that do not need a quarterback. So if the quarterback is still on the board at 27 for the Cardinals. Am I right there? It's the Cardinals.
Arizona, Buffalo, Detroit. You got it. Yep.
Yeah. So if a quarterback is still on the board there for at that point, then 100%. Look, I'm going to say something I know is an unpopular opinion. If I am the New England Patriots at 3, I am taking Marvin Harrison Jr. I'm not taking the leftover quarterback that these other teams want, unless they have rated, you know, whoever is remaining as someone that they think can absolutely come in and star for them for years, then, you know, of course that would be the caveat to that. But we know what Marvin Harrison Jr. is. He's a number one receiver right now, you know, for an NFL team. So, and then look to trade back in. So my initial mock drafts had the Patriots taking Marvin Harrison Jr. and then looking to trade back in. And if someone was available, that three teams in a row, Cardinals, Bills, Lions, they're not going to take a quarterback. Of course they could, you know, be a trade up candidate as well. But we got off track there, you know, forgive me for that. But the talent being pushed down the board for tackles and quarterbacks being taken too early. And I don't mean that those guys aren't good players. I mean, when I say taken too early, some of those guys being taken quarterbacks 4, 5, 6 picks sooner than they should be, or tackles 3, 4, 5 picks sooner than they should be, is going to push players down the board that will give the Ravens more options.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that's one of the exciting things about being at 30. It would be even more exciting to be at 32. And both the Chiefs and the 49ers, in my opinion, will be highly willing to trade their spot to pick up picks, just like the Eagles were in 2018 when they gave up on Lamar Jackson, but I'd give them to the Ravens at 32.
Yep. And they're looking for cheap talent because and hey, credit to the Chiefs to move off on a sidebar again, you know, stop me if you want, but to credit to the Chiefs, you know, they've won two Super Bowls in a row with cheap defense because they drafted exceptionally well. They don't win I don't care to address, you know, what other people will disagree with. They don't win those two Super Bowls without that defense being the caliber that it is. They shut down the Eagles run game. They don't want him without Patrick Mahomes either, but he's not Xerxes. He's not absolutely unstoppable. That defense is what props up that offense for the time periods when, like you said earlier on episode one or the first part, when we were able to stop their offense for periods of time, their defense was able to hold course, obviously. So I think being at the 30 position is great. We could stick and pick, you know, we could stick and pick a guy like Dejean or Dejean, as you pronounce it, a whole bunch of good options there.
By the way, I'm not 100% sure of my pronunciation, but I there was a fair amount of the film I looked at was actually the TV film, and they were calling him Dejean, as in Z-H-E-N-E.
Right, with the modifier on the end, yeah.
So anyway, very cool. Let's continue to move on. I think we only have two players left to discuss, which is good because we've been on for a long time here.
You on four?
My four was Kool-Aid McKinstry, and then your three was Quinion, right?
Yep.
And then my three was Cooper DeJean, and we're up to year two.
Nate Wiggins. Play strength and weight would be a concern, obviously. I saw him against Duke, which is a much better football program than people, certainly Maryland people, we're not in the ACC anymore, obviously, but then we want to give Duke credit for. I actually know three kids in the program at Duke, and that's Manny Diaz is there now, obviously, so they're going to be vastly improved on the defensive side. I saw the Duke game, so I think that will be an outlier, so I'll throw that one out. The Florida State and Notre Dame games, I thought, tell you a lot about Nate Wiggins. First of all, I think he's a more physical football player than people want to give him credit for, even though the play strength isn't great. His RAS score was fantastic. I think 9.43, the initial one. I don't know if there was an adjustment. I really like him. I think that it's possible he's the third or fourth guy taken, even though I personally have him ranked number two behind Terrion Arnold.
Okay.
I'm not as concerned with the weight issues as other people. 170, 173-ish, something like that.
173 is what I've got. And you know, I was a huge Emmanuel Forbes fan last year who was right in that same range, 166 or something. I think he might have weighed in at the combine. But
yeah,
you don't give up on that kind of ball production for that, at least not in my book.
No, I agree. And Wiggins, I thought – I forget who it was I mentioned earlier was scheme versatile. I think it goes without saying that Wiggins is. He doesn't come across as a guy that's going to get in your face and press you and out physical you. I think it was the North Carolina game. I had film of North Carolina's running back. Maybe it was, that he forces a fumble on the one in the second quarter, and that. When I watched it the first time, I thought, I hope that's Nate Wiggins because that's the guy I'm watching this game of. I didn't have that listed in my games that I watched of him. No, I didn't. But he made that play, and it was definitely a fumble. You could see it, you know, that it was forced before the goal line. Right. Told me a whole – similar to Max Melton, the tackle that Melton made, I think, against Michigan, tracking someone down on the other side, just tells you a whole lot about the guy. I'm a huge fan. I mean, do you like him as much as I do or no?
Absolutely love him. He's my number one guy. So first of all, let me talk just a second about that UNC game because I watched it and it's one of the ones that I really enjoyed watching him in. He got beat for the only big play got beat the whole year, and that was a 43-yard pass to Tez Walker.
Yeah,
it didn't go the distance, but it was 43 yards. And then he returned the favor. He got an interception in the game. And he also had that forced fumble. That forced fumble, incredibly high effort play. The play in Ravens history, it reminds me of it. I often analogize in this way, kind of in my head with a visual memory. If you remember Dwayne Stark's rookie year, against the Steelers, first or second game of the year, might have been the second. He ran all the way down the field with when I think it was Jerome Bettis was free for a touchdown. Wow. And he punched the ball out of Bettis's hand with a score 20-13 and maybe 2 minutes left and through the end zone to give the Ravens the ball back and another chance to tie the game. It was one of the most incredible plays I've ever seen. This was like that. It's the same kind of result in terms of being a punch out that led to a touchback. I forget if the ball actually rolled out of the end zone or if they recovered.
Yes, touchback.
Yeah. So anyway, they got the ball at the 20, and the ball game was looking very bleak at that point for for Clemson. But they came back and they scored there to tie it, and then they never looked back and they won the game handily. Might have been 31-20 or something.
Yeah, and North Carolina's running back is a stud, and he fumbled twice in that game. Both times, I believe, inside the 10. And he's a stud.
Omarion Campbell, is that the guy, or is it Omarion?
Something like that. I can't remember exactly, but he's a really good football player, really good running back, and it impressed me. And Nate Wiggins, super athletic. I don't think he makes it past Jacksonville. I think it's Jacksonville, 13, 14, something like that.
Let me look at the draft board here.
I don't think he makes it past them.
He's up at 17, yeah.
Probably 17? Not. Yeah, I don't think he makes it past them. I think he's a hell of a football player. I couldn't pick between the two. I've gone back and forth with Wiggins and Arnold, and I just think Arnold is so classy. I don't necessarily think that he's the better talent. I certainly think that Wiggins is going to be right next to every receiver on every single route. You did mention, I think Walker beat him up the right sideline on like a vertical or something. I can't exactly remember.
Yeah, I think that's right. I've got to think about that for a second here. I see I'm remembering the yardage on the play, and I'm not remembering the play itself for some reason. Anyway, one of the reasons I remember the yardage on the play was the second longest play gave up the whole season was only 18 yards. So you give him a 43-yard play, one, and then 18-yard play. And his coverage metrics are ridiculously good. 4.3 yards per target, a 44.4 opposition passer rating being the lead. They threw at him a fair amount. They just didn't have any success at all doing it. And he's an unbelievably great player. You mentioned all the measurables were terrific. 4:28.40 led all the corners, as I'm sure most people know. His tackling was really good. He had a 13.3% missed tackle rate, which for his frame I thought was outstanding. If you're going to have a concern about him, that might be it. But, you know, he had 8 stops and 4 missed tackles all year. And for a guy they threw at some, I think that's still pretty good. Was penalized just once the entire season. And again, as you mentioned, it's just really a fantasy that the Ravens will get him, unfortunately.
Really, I did. I wouldn't have thought he'd be penalized a lot, but to be only penalized once, he's a super smart corner. He seems to be very technical and athletic at the same time, which, you know, kind of weird or unusual combination. I think he's super well trained, especially for Clemson losing their defensive coordinator. I think he went to Oklahoma. I think is the head coach now. I'm a big fan of Nate Wiggins. I don't share the same concerns of the weight and size being an issue. I think the athleticism is off the chart. So again, the RAS score was fourth highest behind a couple of guys that were not even mentioned, and Jones from Florida State and then Richardson from, I think, Mississippi Darian State. Jones,
yeah. Yeah. Maybe we get to them in the honorable mention category. Cause I got a couple of guys in rounds, maybe great time for like one quick comment about each, but we know who your number one guy is now. Go ahead and talk about him, and then I'll give him a comment or two about him, and we'll move on to some honorable mentions.
I didn't think there were any weaknesses in all the SEC. I started in the Big Ten, as I mentioned earlier, and then ended up in the SEC second, and then miscellaneous, you know, conferences or games thereafter. I didn't think there were any weaknesses. It seemed like Terrion Arnold was a little bit more athletic, that perhaps far more athletic than McKinstry, but I don't know that I can make that valuation. And just as smart, just positioning, really seemed to understand Alabama's system and what they were doing on that side of the field. I wish, you know, it's easy to tell what cover three is. It's easy to tell what Tampa two is. It's easy to tell what some of the hard man free, what hard coded coverages are. I wish there was a way that we could get a hold of you know, what the split field coverage calls were to each side. It's one of the things that really bothers me about some of the rating services when they talk about coverage grades, to be honest with you, because when you're talking about the usage of split field systems now, split field calls, we just don't know. We do not know. Watch a baseball game. You can tell what a slider is. We can tell what a curveball is. We can tell what a changeup is based on the mile per hour and the release of the ball out of the pitcher's hands. We can't tell what, you know, we can't tell what each call is to a particular side unless we get to a point in the season where we're like, okay, Mike McDonald only calls this to his right, which is an actual thing that we did last year.
Still going by context at that point, which I'm perfectly okay with. I just want to stop you for 1 second, push back a little bit on this, because I sometimes get this from ex-players or from people who have a extreme coaching background that basically say they use that sort of language to make less any analysis that is done. And first principles analysis, look, is never perfect. The only thing that's perfect about it is the universe is universal. Is that you're trying to get the entire universe. But whenever you don't know exactly what the call was on the field, and it's true, and you don't know exactly who had what assignment, and it's true, you do the best you can within that context to guess what that is. And it does not throw you off by that much. And probably the place where it does throw you off by the most is in the secondary, where you have rotation of coverages. On the offensive line, I don't think it throws you off by very much at all. I think very few times in an entire football game where you don't know what a player's assignment was by his actions.
Split field coverage is the one.
Yeah.
I would offer the people evaluating it have zero idea how to teach split field coverages. None. and the ones who do is rare. Now, the other things you mentioned, offensive line, 100% agree. You know, inside linebacker play, absolutely agree. Cover three, man free, you know, those hard-coded coverages that are easy to see, totally agree. And here's the way that I will say it. I'll admit to it. I don't know that other people will. I don't know the split field coverage calls. I don't. You know, if it's an out by two and a vertical by one and the corner takes the out by two and the safeties are – okay, that's palms or two read. I know that. If two runs a drag and one runs a – whatever the hell one does, regardless of what the split field coverage call is, the corner should be man on one, period. There's no other work for you. Number two ran away. There's nothing else coming over to your side. So those are the ones that are obvious. There's six or eight or ten other ones that I couldn't tell you what the call was. And so I'm willing to admit that. I think there's a – let's put it this way. I think there's a lot of people out there who aren't willing to admit that. And but you're not wrong, first of all, Ken, because you said it should be part of the evaluation. And that's absolutely true. Like, part of the data should be those things, you know, no doubt. But it shouldn't be as large of a percentage as it is, in my opinion, because you got so many guys that are told, hey, normally in this particular half field call, whatever it is, you know, let's say tan. You know, which isn't even one that people use. I'll say orange. If we're supposed to do a certain thing, but this particular team doesn't run that route combination, then that week we don't call it orange. We might call it, you know, some other color. And so for a particular opponent, there are variations within the half field calls that there is absolutely no way the evaluators know based upon the scheme, the patterns, I guess, maybe, or that the other team shows versus previous teams we've played. I'm not sure if I explained that in a way that makes sense, but there's differential route combinations, plays that are run by the Jags that are not run by the Chargers. And so those half field calls will be different. And I'm willing to admit I have no way of knowing. So.
And part of the beauty of being a team that plays a lot of matchup zone. And when we say that, we mean different side of the field.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not muted. Okay, right. I thought she said no, I was muted. Part of the beauty of that is the disguise. And so it's going to be natural. It's going to be hard for the evaluator to look at that thing as well.
But 100%. Yep.
I'm careful not to discount anything an evaluator says because he's making claims about what coverage he thinks he's seeing in that case. Take your best shot. Take your best shot at that. And yes, I understand because specifically of half field coverages and the need to disguise those is very difficult to classify them accurately.
Yeah, absolutely.
When a pass is out quickly, I mean, you haven't had a chance mm-hmm. for that coverage to develop yep. in that amount of time. So anyway.
Yep. Yeah. That's one of the things I love about it. And it's one of the things that really, I think that 5 years from now, maybe even 2 years from now, there'll be whatever the percentage is. You know, my personal judgment is that I think Mike McDonald used split field coverages 28 to 30% of the time. That may not be the right number. It may be 5, 6, 8% less than that. It may be 5, 6, 8% more. I think I'm in the middle of a 10% range. And I think that there is an optimum number that you should play. And here's what I mean. If you play it 60% of the time, I think you're letting the quarterback and the offensive coordinator know that there's a
trick coming.
There's less traditional coverages that we're playing. And that percentage to me should I even hesitate to use the word should. I think that Mike McDonald showed me. I think I learned from Mike McDonald watching him that number should be just enough so the quarterback has some post-snap uncertainty.
Yeah.
And let's do it this way. Let's say you only played split field coverages 4% of the time. Then that number is low enough that the quarterback, I think, can kind of discount it. There has to be a point at which the number is strong enough, the percentage is prevalent enough, help me out here, that the quarterback is unsure about what he's seeing. And so I'm going to spin that back to my original point. If it gives Joe Burrow pause, it's going to give me pause and whoever else is trying to figure out the coverage too.
That's fair enough. And the comment is exactly correct about there probably is an optimal percentage that you don't want necessarily get away from a base coverage type mm-hmm. to show a trick. And it shows up in two other ways very significantly. One is in the pass rush where the Ravens almost acted like they were on a budget for a number of five-man pass rushes per game this last year. And yeah. almost never rushed six or seven. Really, they very sparsely used them, and they were using them more, I think, this last year, not for the incremental effect of sending a fifth man, but for showing the quarterback that we will send a fifth man some, and so you need to get rid of the ball quickly, and Joe Burrow is a quarterback that really affects. I mean, they have an offense that's very horizontal in its nature, getting that football out. But another one is maybe an easier thing to understand from poker. It is to poker players. It won't be necessarily to everyone, but there's an optimal percentage of the time to bluff in poker. And, mm-hmm. and it works out to be mathematically, it should be about a third of the time that you're bluffing. This is something that I learned from reading Chris Ferguson's writing maybe 20 years ago on the topic. He's a guy who really believes that there's a certain amount. Now, some you know, players like Negreanu and others, they can marionette the person they're playing against so much they can bluff a higher percentage and get away with it. But if you really don't, if you have a range of hands situation and you're really betting on that, bluffing a third of the time ends up being a high value, a value generating mechanic. And I think we see that in other things in life too, but just five-man pass rush, poker, and split field coverages are three great places.
I think it's great. No, that's a great comparison, poker. I think the five-man pass rush applies too in the same vein as the split field coverage calls. The optimum amount of usage such that it's not just it's not a mosquito, it's not a gnat. You know, it's a bee that'll actually sting you occasionally. I like that comparison. I think that I think all evaluation methods should be. What bothers me is to say that a certain corner had this game, and you say that on Monday morning, and you're trying to convince me that you evaluate every Division I corner and every NFL corner, and I know the number of those corners and I know the number of your staff. I can do that math too. So.
Claims can be overdone, certainly on that basis. But let's get back to the task at hand. Talk about the corners, and we got one to talk about left. And you've obviously got him at number one. But what did you like about him?
Terrion Arnold. I mean, he just didn't have any weakness. I didn't think there was anything that dissuaded me from wanting to play him against whatever receiver lined up to his side. Now, part of that is the McKinstry thing too. I mean, if you only had Terrion Arnold. Then someone could move around a Neighbors. They could move around a Thomas. And they did, and LSU did that anyway, I think, as a part of their offense. But you could move to avoid that guy. You really couldn't do that. I think and that's what the that's what the Ravens want. The Ravens want, we want that, right? We want to be able to have Marlon healthy and Brandon Stevens on the other side and kind of give you two choices, none of which are good. And so then, okay, now you got to invert the tight end and the receiver, and you're telling us it's not a run play anyway because we know about the alignment. So I'm interested in what they do. I think, you know, not feasible to say that Terrion Arnold will end up on the Baltimore Ravens next year. But I think there's more guys that are coming out every year who can play multiple coverages. And I don't pigeonhole guys based on what they did do last year versus what they're capable of. Look at McDuffie with the Chiefs.
Yeah.
You know, when he came out, he can do this, but he can't do that. Well, he does every damn thing with the Chiefs, and he does it well.
By the way, McDuffie in recent years is one of the cornerbacks Eric DaCosta missed on by the most. Mm-hmm. Right after the draft, which is dangerous as hell, by the way. Somebody else has got that player. They liked him, obviously. And you say, oh, my God. You know, he was doing some sort of post-draft review, maybe with a private group, and he obviously said something where he kind of shook his head at people who thought McDuffie should have been in the top 20 that draft. Well, now it's totally proven out. He was. I love McDuffie in that draft because he had great production numbers like we've been discussing all night. He was one of those guys who was right around 3.0 yards per target. And I absolutely loved him. But to hear DaCosta put him down after the draft was one of kind of the only negatives that I can recall from the DaCosta era about a you know, really evaluating a player.
Good point. Huh?
Poorly after the draft, right after the draft like that. Yeah,
that seems out of that seems out of the norm for them. That's a good point. I wasn't as high on McDuffie. I didn't think he was a bad player at all. I think that speaks to, again, there's maybe you could say this about every position. You know, feel free to tell me if, hey, Derek, this is the way the draft has always been. I feel like corner every year is gaining in the number of guys who can come in and be your, maybe I shouldn't say McDuffie, but to be your guy that can start, move inside, outside. There seems to me to be more versatility. I think it's, you know, it's one of the larger theories I have. I think I talked about earlier that, you know, the game's being taught in a different way than it was 30 years ago, 20 years ago, even 15, 18 years ago. And the higher percentage pass numbers at the lower levels of football and then college football, I think, is training not just quarterbacks and receivers better, but also corners. I think it's creating a wider net of available players to use every year in these more diverse systems. Hopefully I said that in a way that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know that I could, I would say either way, you know, because I just haven't studied exactly this. I've always hesitant to say something that I really haven't studied, but that there are more first year corners producing, coming into a system and being specifically good in a niche role somehow, which I think, you know, might be what I'm hearing you say. I'm open to the notion of it. I don't know that I could comment either way in terms of whether I think it's really been true.
Yeah. 11 personnel is what led me there. I think it took me, I'd say maybe 2 years to be able to formulate the thought, I guess, maybe even longer than that. I'm not real smart. It took me a while to get there. You know, someone explained it to me. They said, you know, what if you widened the basketball court and created a 5-point line, you know, 2-3 feet deeper than a 3-point line, you're going to have more shooters. You're going to have more guys who can shoot that shot. Well, that's what they damn near have anyway nowadays. But point being, the rules and then what's being utilized to, I don't want to say exploit, but what's being utilized as a natural reaction to the rule set makes sense, is influencing the number of players who shine at particular skills that are used more nowadays. It makes sense. You didn't have as many nickel DBs on the field in 1983 or 1993 or 2003. You know, you have base defenses on the field. The Buffalo Bills are a base nickel defense, even though they didn't have Leslie Frazier this past year. They play a 4-2-5, period. That's what they play. It doesn't matter if you're in 22 personnel. That's what they play. but most teams are matching personnel, and the Ravens are one of them. So in any case, man, I didn't mean to get you off task again, but it's one of my favorite things to do is to talk about the DBs, because I feel like I'm still learning about how the split field coverages impact the game. You heard one of my theories earlier, and you kind of co-signed it. I wish I could find data on what these guys do to a particular half of the field. There's things you should do. Let's do it that way. There's things you should do against a compressed split, against whatever, and there's things you shouldn't. But sometimes these guys do things to be outliers, you know. So,
all right, we're coming right down to the finish line here. I'll cut a couple comments on Terry and Arnold. First, fantastic ball production near the top of his class with 5 interceptions and 12 PDs. Might have been at the top of his class. That was 17. I don't have his total targets here. 5.6 yards per target was not at the top. Of course, he's playing a lot of SEC receivers, not traveling though. You know, so they got the matchups they wanted against Terry and Arnold basically the entire season. And a 50.7 opposition passer rating is just fine for facing a hell of a lot of good players in that. I don't think the chance is 100% he's gone at number 30. You know, this may be sacrilege here, but I like the other guys so much in this first round. Even though I had him at number 2, I think there's maybe a 15% chance he's still on the board at 30.
You mean like there's 3 or 4 other guys that other teams just really like?
Yeah.
And they
Wiggins, DeJean is you know, the same are certainly first round picks. And then, you know, what if Quinion is the guy that somebody likes? What if somebody likes really Kool-Aid better than Terry and Arnold?
Do you think the number of quarterbacks and tackles projected to go also is a factor there?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it's one of the things we always like really are doing on draft night is in wondering how does this affect the Ravens. We're really looking at where do the Ravens not have positional needs and how great it is when a non-positional need gets drafted. So obviously, we want 6 quarterbacks to go in round 1. That's the first of all needs.
I know you do. I know you do. I know you do. But I don't know another way to begin this question. Do you remember when the Ravens drafted Kyle Hamilton? Like all of the conjecture and all of the, you know, now there were also people who were like, hey, this guy does X, Y, and Z extremely well, you know, but I remember so many untoward and off target statements similar to what you mentioned about DaCosta with McDuffie that have now been totally flipped on, you know. There's the immediate reaction and oftentimes we're off base with it.
Well, I all I'll say is both my immediate reaction, the organic reaction from draft night is still out there on video record if anybody wants to look, as is the day after review of the Ravens selections. And loved the Kyle Hamilton pick in real time and loved it the day after as well. So
yeah, man,
I'm not feeling bad about that one. There's probably other picks though that people would pick, in the Linderbaum pick from that same draft, I was less high on than a lot of people were.
I like how we're willing to draft physical anomalies. Kyle Hamilton is a physical anomaly in one direction. He's the Incredible Hulk as a nickel safety who can also step back and play half field safety, middle of the field safety if you need him to. I don't think that's his relative strength. I think his overwhelming superiority is nickel safety. Then Tyler Linderbaum, a smaller offensive lineman, if you will. Zay Flowers, a smaller receiver. I would say that those three guys, while they're different positions and they're anomalies in a different way, they are anomalies for the position they're drafted at, and the Ravens were willing to go get them. So I guess from that standpoint, for this year's draft, like, I shouldn't discount anything for what they will do if they think a player fits, or if they think a player is just too good to pass on, even if he doesn't fit, right?
Yeah, the draft is always a ton of fun for exactly that reason. As much as everybody talks about in advance, you just don't know what's going to happen. And something interesting always happens, usually starting with a stupid pick by the Raiders. That's, you know, a non-economical pick. You know,
who's
the edge they drafted at number 4?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Talk about this. Arnett and all the other guys they drafted in the high that made everybody else's boards look that much better.
it'll trickle. That's right. It'll trickle down and help us, you know, because someone will. And there'll be one or two teams that trade up, you know, to for receiver or tackle that'll help us as well.
Okay. Now here's what I want to do. And I want to do this kind of really quickly because we're way late on time here, but let's pick one player from round four that we have not named that you'd be cool as a value pick in round four for the Ravens. And I've got a couple guys, but who would be your guy that we haven't named yet tonight?
One or two?
One, you name one just from round four. We'll do one from round five and maybe one from round six.
Ooh, I don't know that he's a round four guy. I can't pronounce his first name. It's like the fifth different way I've tried to. Richardson, the corner from, I think, Mississippi State. Elite athleticism. Or, wait a minute, do I have that wrong? Is it Ole Miss? Elite athleticism. State. Yeah, Mississippi. I mean, up there with Quinyon Mitchell. He would be one. I almost wanted to say a different guy, but your turn.
Okay, so my guy would be Jerrion Jones of Florida State. I do have another guy, DJ James of Auburn, but the Jerrion Jones – could move into a hybrid role, or I mean, he could play slot and he could play outside, or simply play obvious passing downs in his first year in 11 personnel at slot corner, which I think, you know, would push Maulette out of a job, but would still be a great pick in terms of the future for the Ravens.
Yeah, I'm wondering about that. If the Ravens get the opportunity to draft someone who can play a little bit of both, mm-hmm. you know, if that dissuades them, because they really. I think at this point for 2024, they're really looking for someone who can play outside corner. But I mean, I think you're of the same opinion I am. We would be happy. We would both be content if the Ravens played more six DBs in third and six or longer. You know, that would be my offering. I'm not sure why we have certain guys on the field at a certain time, but Kalen Carson, he's a nasty physical corner. He's from North Point, the SMAC, Southern Maryland Athletic Conference. Wake Forest guy. Don't think his RAS testing was that great. I don't have it even on screen. I'm probably a little biased because he's a Maryland guy. But I really love his nastiness. I like how he is. I really like how he is in zone. They seem to play him a lot in zone. I thought he was a little more of an anticipation guy or film study guy as far as down the field routes. Like he was looking for a particular route. And so I don't know what it would look like if he got a different route than the one he was anticipating. Does he have the speed and athleticism to make up that difference like a Kyrie Jackson does? I'm not sure if he does.
All right. A good one. I didn't like his production, but otherwise I liked him as a player. And if he's a smart player, the Ravens may really like that about him. They certainly have a history of going after smart guys. My fifth round guy would be Elijah Jones of Boston College, and he may or may not still be there in round five. I think he probably will. He's got the aircraft carrier size at 6'2", 184. What I really liked about him was outstanding 2023 results, and there's no substitute for it in the end. And the fifth round, of course, was where Caillou Bluekelly got drafted last year. He's now been released by three different teams since then. Bad results, obviously. You know, if you followed that, might have done it. But Jones was at 4.9 yards per target and opposing passer rating of 18 this last year, which was the third best in all of college football.
Really good RAS score too, right up there with Cam Hart, like right around the 8.9, 8.9.2. So both of those guys, you know, Cam Hart's the other one from Maryland. I'm actually going to do a video on the three.
He's a good one.
Maryland kids, Carson, Hart and Jackson, three different routes to the NFL. Hopefully they get, you know, but as an aside, how amazing is it that potentially two top 10 picks from the same high school with DC, Caleb Williams and Fashanu, both went to Gonzaga.
Pretty cool.
Yeah.
Is there an undrafted guy you like? I got one.
I'm not as big of a fan of Chris Abrams. He's not going to be an undrafted guy. I like Quantez Stiggers. I don't think he'll be an undrafted guy either. The CFL guy who didn't play college football. I really like him. I don't think he makes it to being an undrafted guy, though.
Okay. The guy I like, give me Javon Bullard of Georgia as an undrafted guy. I'm not going to spend a draft pick on him, but it's not because I want him to play corner. I want to move him to split field safety.
Absolutely.
The characteristics to play there.
Yeah, he's a safety. I think he's a safety, totally. I think he's a really good football player. I think he's illustrative of the overall point that we've touched on three or four times, which is that there's a lot of good players out there, you know, such that a guy like him, he's from Georgia, right? So, Georgia, I mean, yep. He's a good player at Georgia, and he potentially could be a sixth, seventh, or undrafted guy, like you said.
Just an absolute pleasure to do this with you, Coach. Why don't you tell people again where they can find your work online or talk to you if they'd like to?
Well, here lately, not much. I've been too busy, but YouTube, you know, All 22 Films is turned into something that I never would have dreamed of, and it's just pure fun. And then on Twitter, X as well, All 22 Films or All 22 NFL Cuts, whatever it is, figure it out. If not, it's my fault for not having the correct proper handle. So, you know, I appreciate you having me, man. It's fun. Wish we could have, you know, been able to go over some other positions, but I think it's really cool how you do this with one person for each position. Cause for me, at least, it gave me something to focus on, a group. And I really still don't even feel like I got to all the players. I didn't get to the Tennessee kid that you named either. I saw him, but didn't get to quote evaluate him like some of these other guys. So it's really cool that you did this because you're like orchestrating really focused, intense film study by people, and then also you're being able to provide that information to your audience while you're just in the middle of it, like, you know, the Wizard of Oz.
I appreciate that. Happy, hopefully there's none of the fraud of the Wizard of Oz involved.
None of that was intended, nor the age stuff.
No, I understand. yes, the age would also fit. But anyway, this has just been a labor of love for me, and I there's no way I could do it, A, without Maureen's help, but B, also without being retired, you know, from doing anything else. So I know most other people, they have jobs, they have lives, they have other things they're doing, so. I'm fortunate that I get to do it. I hope people will join us on draft night. We're hoping to have a lot of different content creators on as panelists at different times during the show. It's a very relaxed, I wouldn't call it relaxed, actually. I get pretty upset about things, so do other people there. And we get into some intense discussions and some great questions, but we're looking for that involvement. We're really looking to involve the folks that are watching, possibly get you on camera for a question if that's what you like, or just answer a question that you're tossing about in a chat group as well. But looking forward, we'd love to have you there. And we'll be on for all 3 days and all 9 picks for the Ravens have at the least. We'll be on air.
It's pretty cool, man, that you guys offer that. You need with all the technology nowadays, you need a wrap it up box for people. It's a reference that probably goes too young for you. Forgive me. It's Chappelle's Show.
What is it?
Chappelle's Show. It's a wrap it up box, basically, like, you know, 45 seconds and then your time is up. So, you know, if you were looking for a way to succinctly give people, myself included, perhaps on draft night, less time to say what they had to say, then you could just some kind of way to automatically mute after 45 seconds. There's got to be something like that available, right? Wrap it up box. Great segment.
It could just come up as a you know, a thing in bold letters with an exclamation point after
exactly
on the screen. Yeah, that'd be fun. All right. Coach, really appreciate having you on.
Yeah, man. Thanks a lot, man. I appreciate it. And thank you guys that listened, you know, to the whole thing and do a great job, you know, with what you provide the people and also with giving us opportunities to come on and try to show people the things that we do know about and then admit when we don't know, you know, as much as we think we do.
Thanks again, Coach. And we'll talk to you next time on Film Study.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.